Is he gonna fly in or something?
Tim will tell us all about it.
Oh, this is gonna be exciting.
Let there be light, right? Someone else said that.
Beverly, won't you stand in front of the microphone so that we can check the lights for our lovely video? Ed, thumbs up.
Yeah.
Bob. Very good. In lieu of the Star Spangled Banner. The John's been up all night, drilling a hole in the wall, listening to the howl, waiting on that call. Between Chinatown and hell, he's been sharpening his hooks and memorizing the lines out of the pages of band books. Got down on his knees by the riverside and stared straight down the arrow of time. He's bathed in the light of a blood-red sun, standing in that doorway, waiting on that revolution to come. Miles of barbed wire sit between the holy cities. A band of criminals drive the bloodstained streets and the towers of Babylon. Celebrate the broken covenant. They can't wash their hands of the sorrow they wrought. The creed of brotherhood's forgotten and lost. They tag the word democracy on the whitewashed walls of the burned out homes of the innocent souls. And that's where the revolution begins to take hold. Scores of angels slip between the darker beast that seem all lost amongst that desperate brutality. They march past blank stairs, blind pillars of salt. Heave gravel in to the machinery of bar. They've seen the death of prophets and the death of dreams. They've seen the pure terror of science and steel. They understand these times of guns and mayhem. They know the next revolution begins within. John's been up all night, drilling a hole in the wall, listening to the howl, waiting on that call. Between Chinatown and hell, he's been sharpening his hooks and memorizing lines out of the pages of band books. Got down on his knees by the riverside. He stared straight down the arrow of time. He's bathed in the light of a blood-red sun, standing in that doorway, waiting on that revolution to come. Hi there, I'm Tim Ways. Welcome to Human Thread Gallery. Welcome to Media Democracy 2011. A big round of applause for Beverly, who's been all the energy and force behind Media Democracy today. What a terrific activist, what a terrific resource. We're lucky to have her in Chicago. I think she's a remarkable woman. Thank you all for coming out. We may have a small, tight environment here, but we appreciate you coming out, and we appreciate you being a part of the festivities. Human Thread is this gallery and center for peace. We welcome your contributions and donations. We welcome your volunteer efforts. What we're busy doing here is, on a monthly basis, we present artists that We select that have a message, that have something to say about social consciousness. The artist this month is Carlos Carbonera, correct? And he's got really awesome, terrific work, says a lot about the things that we're talking about this evening, so we did select him with that in mind. And there will be a artist reception next Friday, second Fridays here in Pilsen. You're welcome to come on out. We have a little bit of food and a little bit of wine then as well, and you get to meet the artist and speak with him. So we've got the second Fridays. Then every third Friday of the month, we host an open mic here. Now, it's a special open mic. It's called Open Mind Open Mic. So we invite you here to come here, have a political discussion, perform, dance, sing. We don't care. Whatever it is you want to do, come out and participate. Part of the event is to talk about peace and nonviolence. So Human Thread, that's our message. That's what we're about. And nonviolence in traditional method, in terms of what Gandhi espoused, which is a very active effort at nonviolence. So besides the open mind, open mic that we host here every third Friday at 7 p.m., we also have a program by which we are going into high schools and junior high schools throughout Chicagoland. I think we have about a half dozen schools in the program right now. And Michiko Kobayashi is my partner in Human Thread, and she leads this effort where we go into the schools and we spend a couple hours with students and we help them facilitate their own open mind, open mic discussion. So we'll have upwards of 75 to 100 students performing, but also speaking about issues and things, problems that they're, you know, that they're facing, you know, in today's world. And there's been a tremendous reaction to it. It's a very, you know, at the infancy of the program, but so far great success, very popular with the kids. Name the high schools that we're at, Michiko.
Hyde Park Academy, Tilden, Elementary, and King Elementary, and a few more
are coming. Right. So it is successful, and schools are interested in doing this. So we need volunteers. We need support to, you know, keep this thing going. So we have that. We also have a tutoring program here on Saturday mornings. So earlier today, all this stuff was out of here, and we get a couple of tutors in here for reading and math. And we'll get anywhere from two to a half dozen or more young people in here. We do a little bit of tutoring in reading and math, but we also spend a little bit of time as well on issues of nonviolence. We're doing that. Something else we're doing? Have I remembered everything?
I don't know. I mean, one more speaker series is something that we try to do on a monthly basis too. But this month, we're combining
Very good. Michiko Kobayashi. This space is available for your events if it's appropriate for the size. We're happy to work with you. So grab a card from us. We've got postcards for the artists. So feel free to sign our mailing list and all that. Also, I have a band, Jungle of Cities, and it kind of meshes with all the things we're doing here as well. So on December 2nd at Multiculti, there is a benefit performance for Occupy Chicago, as well as for Terra Firma Productions, which is a independent media organization. Is there someone from Terra Firma? There you are. Did you want to say anything about Terra Firma?
Yeah, it's at its beginning phase right now. There was an organization supported by NEIS, which is Nuclear Energy Information Services, and they are now supporting training at CAN TV for people participating in that organization.
Very cool. So December 2nd is a benefit for Occupy Chicago as well as Terra Firma. That'll be at Multiculti, and that's 1000 North Milwaukee. Doors open at 6 p.m. There will be art, there will be music, there will be fashion show. So you got everything there. So thank you very much for your time. Thanks for sitting through the commercial. Okay. Beverly.
Glad all of you are here. And again, I want to thank Tim and Michiko for making this. It just has wonderful energy because of who they are and what they're doing. So again, thank you all. To get on right with the program, we're going to be really informal tonight. I do want to say two things. We are here, or the idea behind this is actually two purposes. One is to remember how important democracy is, how important the media is, and how important media democracy is. And that we need to be very aware of what is going on and what we can do as activists and as media professionals to break through the corporatist media and get the message out. And so hats off to people like Tim and Michiko and what Mike Callis and other people are doing to get that message out. And the other part of it is, and also to get information, and we have really terrific speakers tonight. The other part is we need to network. And the only way we can really network is if we know each other. And so another part of this event is for us to have a chance to get together. It's been a tough year, so to have a good time and really get to know each other. So encourage you all. I think we can say after nine, can't we?
Sure.
We can say after nine. So I could encourage you to stick around, help yourself maybe to some more food, coffee, the wine, and really, you know, exchange those cards, exchange your ideas, how we can do a better job of getting the word out to people. And of course, we have terrific panelists. And beginning with Steve Masek, who is right here. Steve Masek teaches at North Central College in communication, and he is currently writing a book on the history of media in Chicago. So he will go first and give us a little bit of a background. I think he's going to focus on progressive media. Our second speaker will be Mitchell Stepanchik over here, and that is Zachary at the back and Bree. Mitchell is one of the key people at Chicago Media Action. And if you haven't already checked out their website, it's really worthwhile. It'll give you a real quick insight into the media issues, key stories. And thanks to Mitchell and Scott Sanders, who was not able to be here tonight, work sort of came and took over. But they do a great job in that website. And Mitchell's gonna bring us up to date a little bit about the big stories of this year and what they mean and what they might mean for us next year. Then Jeanette Foreman, back there, okay, has been working on a project, number of projects, but one of them is a joint project with Steve Franklin from Community Media Workshop. It's a community stories and getting stories in the local papers project. She's going to be talking about that. Unfortunately, Maureen Murphy from, if you are familiar with Maureen, everyone familiar with Maureen Murphy? Okay, if you're not, I'll just key you in. She is one of those people who has been harassed by the FBI for her activities as speaking out and covering the issue of what's happening in Palestine, and she has been targeted. She is a very brave individual as well as a talented and dedicated journalist, and I'm very sorry that she was not able to be here tonight. The other person who unfortunately is not with us is Michael Owens, who is one of the people, I know there are no leaders, but one of the people who helped with organizing Occupy Chicago. And I figured that instead, since a lot of us have been down there, imagine, anyone here been down to Occupy Chicago?
Okay, so I think we can kind of fill in on some of the events there and update each other. So what I will do is I will turn it over first to Steve Masek, and then I would ask each of you just to come up and not bother with, you know, having me come up again, and just introduce yourself. Mm-hmm. So Steve will have about 15 minutes or so, and then because he's trying to cover a lot of history, I've asked Mitchell and Jeanette to keep their remarks to about 10 minutes. I will give you the 2 minute sign,
yeah,
and then the 1 minute, the 1 minute sign. And since our other two speakers are not with us, we might have time for a couple of questions afterwards, and then we will go to the symposium, and that's for all of us. Maybe we can sort of rearrange the chairs in a circle or something, so we can go right into the symposium. Okay, Steve?
Let's see if I can get this up and working. So I guess my charge is to talk about the history of people's media in Chicago. And people's media has kind of a long and rich history here in the city of Chicago. Some of you may be aware of the bits and pieces of this history, but most people are not aware of kind of the rich, rich history of sort of democratic and people's media here in the city. Chicago was home to the first anarchist daily newspaper in the world, not just in the country, in the world, home to the to what at one point was the highest circulation socialist newspaper probably anywhere in the United States, Chicago Daily Socialist, home to the only labor union owned radio station anywhere in the country, WCFL, home to what was for 50 years the leading African American owned daily newspaper in the country, the Chicago Defender. Sorry, do you need me to speak into this? Okay. So there's a very rich history here, and I'm just going to kind of skim across the surface of that history and give you some of the highlights. And I'm going to see if I can get this to work. All right. Hang on. Is that
yes?
Is that working? Okay.
Yeah.
So you may want to turn the, you may want to get the lights here. All right. So you can see some of this. It's not so important now, but it will be important a little bit later. And is there any way to hit that light?
Sure.
Okay. Because that's right, shining right there. So let me just give you very quickly a quick overview of the history of the media in Chicago. You know, as you probably all know, Chicago became, in the mid-19th century, the leading industrial city in the United States because of its proximity to Lake Michigan, because it was a major rail hub. A number of big industries took root here, the meatpacking industry, lumber industry, furniture industry, the printing industry, and that attracted legions and legions of immigrants coming to this country looking for jobs. They flooded into Chicago, lived in often very horrible living conditions on the near west side and down in Pills. And it also, Chicago, though, you know, as it was booming, gave rise to a vibrant local media scene. By 1880, the city had 11 daily newspapers, dozens of weekly newspapers, including dailies published in German, Czech, and Norwegian. All of those newspapers were locally owned. This is something that changes later on. Fast forward 50 years, Chicago doubled its population several times in the space of those 50 years, growing from a city of about 500,000 to a city of close to 3 million. By 1930, the city boasted 38 daily newspapers. Now, a number of those daily newspapers were actually very specialized trade journals of various kinds, you know, a trade journal for lawyers, trade journal for various industries, seven of those papers were general interest, advertising, supported English language publications. A number of them were foreign language publications. There were, at one point, three daily newspapers being published in Yiddish in the city of Chicago. Believe it or not, each one belonging to a different kind of political tendency. There was a conservative paper, there was a socialist paper, and there was a communist paper. In the 1920s, the city saw a proliferation of radio stations. including the only radio station in the U.S. ever owned by a labor union, WCFL, and I'll get back to that. By the 1950s, though, what we see is that the number of English language daily newspapers in the city had dwindled to four. There were just four papers. So from 38, right, 20 years later, that number had dwindled to four. And most of the foreign language dailies had become weeklies or had closed down. And by 1971, we fast forward even further, concentration of ownership becomes even more, over the media, becomes even more pronounced in the city. By 1971, according to one estimate, the Tribune Company, which is the parent company of the Chicago Tribune, at that time owned two daily newspapers, Chicago's American, which used to be the Hearst newspaper in town, the afternoon newspaper, in the morning, Chicago Tribune, a radio station, WGN, and a TV station, WGN. According to one estimate, they controlled 46% of all the advertising revenue pulled in by all of Chicago's media, and the Tribune Company, Field Enterprises, which was the parent company that owns a television station in Chicago, as well as the Chicago Sun-Times, and the three national TV networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, between them, according to this estimate, controlled 92% of Chicago's commercial media, and at that time, the commercial media were the by far the dominant media. And today, of course, commercial media in Chicago are in crisis, and concentration of ownership in the city of Chicago, as we've discovered, is worse than ever. Now, the big problem with the commercial press in Chicago isn't actually that it became increasingly concentrated in the hands of a few corporate owners, although that was bad enough. The biggest problem, from my perspective, with the commercial press was its persistent, and has been, its persistent conservative ideology and its anti-labor, anti-radical bias. And this goes way, way, way back to the 1870s, to the very beginning. So here I'm just going to read you a couple of quotes. Here's one from Joseph Medill. This was in an editorial. He was the editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune, an editorial published in Chicago Tribune in 1875 in praise of lynching. And in this case, he was praising the lynching of strikers. Judge Lynch is an American by birth and a character. The Vigilance Committee is a peculiarly American institution. Every lamppost in Chicago will be decorated with a communistic carcass, if necessary, to prevent wholesale incendiarism. And this is actually a couple of years before the massive rail strike of 1877. Chicago Times, which is another leading newspaper of the late 19th century, was no better. Here's what they say. Hand grenades should be thrown among those union sailors who are striving to obtain higher wages. As by such treatment, they would be taught a valuable lesson, and other strikers would take warning from their fate. You can find dozens of quotes like this from editorials that appeared in the Times, in the Daily News, the Chicago Tribune, the leading commercial papers. And it is because of this that people develop their own media. I think it's important when we're talking about the history of people's media to understand that people's media is always sort of in some degrees being created in reaction to the dominant commercial for-profit media. I can only really scratch the surface of the history of people's media. If you want the whole story, buy my book. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. But there are a number of actually excellent books that cover various aspects of the history of people's media. I want to focus specifically on the history of radical and labor media because I think it's the aspect of the history of people's media in Chicago that's least talked about. In fact, already in the late 1860s, there was a weekly newspaper that was the voice of labor in Chicago, an English language newspaper called the Workman's Advocate. It was started, like a lot of early labor papers, it was started by a printer, and a printer who had been employed by the Chicago Times and who was locked out by the owner of the Chicago Times in a strike. He promptly brought in scab labor to replace all the locked out printers. And this guy, A.C. Cameron, who was a Scottish-born printer and also sort of a labor intellectual, sort of an organic intellectual from the working class, started a paper called The Workman's Advocate. Now, I don't have actually any copies. I have not been able to actually look at any copies of The Workman's Advocate myself. They don't have them at the Chicago History Museum Research Center. This is an ad for The Workman's Advocate, but for years, The Workman's Advocate advocated things like universal male suffrage, like an 8-hour workday, and persistently critiqued the commercial press in Chicago. It lasted, a lot of these radical and labor papers didn't last very long. It lasted for, I think, a mere 18 years or so before folding in the late 1870s. Now, another important newspaper, really very important newspaper, that I think you should know about is a paper called the Chicago Arbeiter Zeitung, which means the Chicago Workers' Newspaper in German. It started out as the official party organ of a socialist party that was started here in Chicago by a number of German-speaking labor unions called the Workmen's Party. Initially it started out as a weekly paper, but the Workmen's Parties would hold these celebrations in the 1870s. Of commemorating the Paris Commune. I don't know how many of you know what the Paris Commune is, but this was, Marx wrote about it as the festival of the oppressed. It was a time when the government of the city of Paris during the Franco-Prussian War was taken over by workers. And it was sort of, in the eyes of Karl Marx, a kind of prefiguring of what communist society would look like. It was arguably the most democratic government, you know, that had existed at any point up to that time. And so they would hold these celebrations of the Paris Commune every year. They would have dances, singing, a big picnic. They would, these choral societies, German choral societies, would get together and sing worker songs. And they raised so much money at these annual Paris commune celebrations that they were able to turn the Chicago Arbeiter Zeitung from a 3-day-a-week publication into a daily publication. And its politics were pretty much socialist until they elected, and the way that it worked, it was a cooperative. Members who were members of the German-speaking socialist unions owned shares in the paper, and they elected the editor. And no editors really served for more than 3 or 4 years at a time. It became an anarchist newspaper when they elected a man by the name of August Spies, one of the great Haymarket martyrs, the editor of the Chicago Arbeiter Zeitung, and then they moved in the direction, a much more militant direction, and started espousing kind of anarchist ideology. All right, you all probably know what happened to the Haymarket martyrs, so I really don't need to say much more, except to say that August Spies used the printing presses of the Chicago Arbeiter Zeitung to print the famous circular calling people to a mass rally at Haymarket Square that, of course, led to the confrontation and the tragedy, which led to the 8 anarchists being, you know, indicted and 4 of them being hung. The anarchist movement in Chicago in the 1880s actually published 4 newspapers in a number of different languages. Most of them were weeklies, and the English, interestingly, it says something about the working class of Chicago, which was, you know, 25% German-speaking, that the English-language anarchist newspaper in Chicago, The Alarm, which was edited by another Haymarket martyr, Albert Parsons, was only a weekly, whereas the Chicago Arbeiter Zeitung was a daily. And this is an image of The Alarm, front page of The Alarm. And one of the things that Parsons did was sing the praises of direct action against the capitalist class. And here's one of his famous articles that was actually used as evidence against Parsons in his trial at Haymarket, advocating or giving instructions on how to build a dynamite bomb. Now, interestingly, I just want to say a couple more things about the Chicago Arbeiter Zeitung. It survived the crisis of 1886 and of the Haymarket trial. And in fact, almost every person associated with the Arbeiter Zeitung was arrested following Haymarket, thrown in jail. Some of them, of course, were later executed, like August Spies. But the German-speaking Bakers Union levied a 1% tax on all of their members to raise enough money to reopen the paper. And it continued to publish into the 20th century as a German language daily paper. Now, the circulation of the Chicago Arbeiter Zeitung never got more than really 15,000. And that circulation was mostly local, and circulation really dwindled in the 20th century because the number of anarchists, frankly, involved in the left in Chicago dwindled in the 20th century. It just no longer was popular. Socialism, communism became more important. But what I think is really interesting is another newspaper produced by the working class movement in the 20th century did at one particular moment in history manage to achieve a circulation, combined circulation of its newspapers of about 300,000, and at one point was the leading newspaper in the city. And that's what I'm going to talk to you about now. All right, this paper, the Workers' Call, was founded the end of the 19th century by the Chicago section of the Socialist Labor Party, which later morphed into the Socialist Party of America. That's, I guess, the most important thing you need to know about it. And it was edited by a guy by the name of A.M. Simmons, who became a kind of leading figure in the American socialist movement. And initially, it was a weekly paper. And among other things, the paper routinely attacked the capitalist media, what they called the capitalist media. So I just want to draw, I know you can't really see this very well, but this article over here that says muddled is actually a critique of a Chicago Tribune editorial talking about how it is the Chicago Tribune is spewing bourgeois reactionary ideology. This was common for the Workers' Call to sort of frame every one of their issues around an attack on the propaganda of the capitalist and mainstream media. They also did other things. They advocated for women's suffrage. They advocated for an 8-hour workday. They were strenuous supporters of limits on child labor, which was a serious, serious problem. And they did exposés on the living condition of the working class in Chicago, which at the turn of the century were pretty horrific in places like the Near West Side, Taylor Street, and so on. They did a lot of stories on the conditions in tenement houses. A lot of the tenement apartment buildings were not very sanitary. A lot of them didn't have running water, and you had whole families of immigrants crowded together in these apartments intended for, say, four people. You'd have seven people living there, and then in order to pay the exorbitant rents, they would have to bring in a boarder. So they would have an additional one or two people living in their kitchen, usually. And so they would do exposés on that. They also did a number of exposés on conditions in the packing houses, which were really awful. They never were able to raise enough money initially from subscriptions to pay for the cost of printing the paper. So a lot of radical and labor newspapers, they held events as fundraisers, periodic events, and here's one of them, the third annual reception and ball for the benefit of the Workers' Call. They held a dance of various kinds. Now, they did carry advertising, which I think is interesting, and increasingly carried more advertising, but it was for businesses who self-identified as socialists. So one of my favorite ads was an ad for a cafe on Halsted Street, which I guess is just over there, right? Mm-hmm. It was an ad for a cafe on Halsted Street, and the ad copy read, "Socialists have sensitive stomachs, so you should come, you should come down and eat at this cafe," which is sort of owned by a pro-socialist owner. Later, when the Socialist Labor Party became the Socialist Party, they renamed themselves the Chicago Socialists, And they made more of an effort to kind of to reach out to people who were not among the converted, that is to say, weren't party members, and circulation increased. So in the first part of the 20th century, in the first decade of the 20th century, circulation increased to about 40,000 by 1906, 1907, and you can see that they incorporated lots of visual evidence elements of various kinds, and they had some really talented cartoonists who would draw cartoons that sort of illustrated, for example, here it is, our program, showing all the places that capitalists, that are off limits to capitalists. They want the whole world owned by capitalists, all right. They also relentlessly, in their cartoons, attacked the mainstream capitalist press. And here you have this beautiful illustration of how State Street stores, who are advertisers in the Daily News and the Chicago Tribune, are corrupting the news. Because here you have a State Street store owner dictating the contents of the daily newspaper, right? Because they are the sponsors paying for the advertising. And there, here again, you have the Miss State Street, who's doling out pie to all of the capitalist press, the Tribune, the Record Herald, the Inner Ocean, the Chronicle, the Daily News. And here you have this Daily Socialist answering the question, why do the dogs howl? Because they want more pie. like I said, the Daily Socialist was, the Socialist was particularly concerned about was child labor. This was a big issue for the Socialist movement. Here's one of my favorite cartoons ever, showing boyhood's joys that are never his, showing this kid walking into the maw of the factory, which is a death's head, and leaving behind all of the pleasures that he could have had. And surveys, just, and I know I only have 2 minutes, let me just say, anecdotally, there was one survey that Jane Addams and her colleagues at Hull House did of the families in the neighborhood around Hull House in the early 20th century, and they found that only 2% of school-aged kids were actually in school. That's because they were either working in garment factories as newsboys, shoeshine people, or they were home taking care of their younger siblings because their mothers were working 10 to 12 hour days, 6 days a week. So this was a huge issue, and it was one of the big organizing issues of the socialist movement. Another one of my favorite cartoons, which I would like to make into a t-shirt. The program of capitalism for the capitalist class, it's leisure, education, and all the way down, wine, women, and song. For the working class, starvation, wages, child labor, long hours or lack of employment, trust prices, adulterated drugs, fraudulent weight, insufficient food, scorn, contempt, social ostracism, and economic dependence. And then underneath there it says, he will vote the socialist ticket. which is, I think, a great, great sentiment. Well, okay, I've only got 2 minutes left, so let me just tell you how this newspaper became the highest circulation newspaper in the city of Chicago. In 1912, the printers went on strike against the newspapers. There were two newspapers in town owned by William Randolph Hearst. They went on strike against the printers. The printers went on strike against the papers owned by William Randolph Hearst. And in response, all the other mainstream commercial newspapers in town locked out their printers because they had an agreement. It was called the Newspaper Trust, or the newspaper cartel. They had an agreement that if one of the papers was being struck, that the other papers would also lock out their printers. So all the printers at every one of the papers, commercial, mainstream, ad-supported papers in town, were locked out. And they brought in scabs to try to restart production. And the truck drivers went out on strike in sympathy with the striking printers. The newsboys, and this was very important, there was a union of newsboys, some of them as young as six, they also went out on strike and they refused to handle struck newspapers. That meant that there were only two papers that Newsboys would sell on the streets of Chicago. One was the Chicago Daily Socialist, which by this time had become a daily newspaper. The other was a small ad-free newspaper called The Daybook. So, overnight, the circulation of the Socialist went from about 40,000 to about 100,000. In fact, they quickly raised money from the striking printers' unions to add new printing presses. They scrambled to hire new writers from socialist papers all around the country, especially from Milwaukee, which had a very vibrant socialist newspaper, the Milwaukee Leader, to come down and work for the Chicago Daily Socialist. And then they split. The Chicago Daily Socialist actually started a morning and an evening paper, which they renamed The World, The Morning World, and the Daily World, and The Evening World. And the combined circulation of those papers, which were really the Chicago Daily Socialist, reached 300,000. Now, the problem was that very shortly after they reached that point, and were being read by all these ordinary Chicagoans, because they had really no other outlet, the strike was settled. And when that happened, all of these new printing presses that they bought sort of, had to stop. They stopped, and they ground to a halt. Of course, they didn't drop down back down to 40,000, but they could no longer survive at a circulation of 50 or 60,000, and within a few months, they had to declare bankruptcy. So it's a very sad story of a moment when the People's Press became the press of Chicago. In fact, there was the Streetcar Workers Union during the 1912 strike fined any member caught reading any paper other than the Socialist $5. If they were caught on the street, you know, one of the workers was caught reading a paper that wasn't the Daily Socialist, they were fined $5. So there was a moment when the people's media was, in fact, everyone's media, and then sadly it ground to a halt. That's all the time I have. I can talk forever about this stuff, but I will stop.
Thanks. Thank you.
Presentation, I will be giving a list. My name is Mitchell Stripanchik. I'm with Chicago Media Action. You can find us online at chicagomediaaction.org. We have a sign-up sheet and flyers on the table in the back. I will be speaking to you about the leading, you could call them media democracy-related stories of the past year. In this presentation, I will be giving what I deem to be the most significant media democracy-related stories of the past year. I will, for this presentation, define the past year to include the time since the previous Media Democracy Day in early November 2010. I am going to tell 9 main stories in all, ordered roughly by the amount of attention that they have received in wider awareness, from most popular to least popular. Story number 1, Occupy Wall Street. The typical corporate template for covering left grassroots activism is to ignore it completely, unless and until it grows too big to ignore, then belittle those efforts, thus dismissing those efforts in the broader public mind. Often, that works, mainly because those grassroots efforts have a too short a shelf life to respond back. But Occupy Wall Street was different in that it didn't have that kind of usual expiration date. The New York Times coverage of Occupy Wall Street, for one instance, saw the paper ignoring the story in its initial setup in early weeks, then craven dismissal of it in a couple of articles, but then coverage of the protest would galvanize 3 times in the wake of 3 subsequent police attacks, followed by an op-ed of some support at the same time that dozens and by now thousands of sister Occupy efforts sprung up nationwide. Occupy Wall Street efforts show that in gaining media coverage, which can make or break many activist efforts in the present time, persistence does pay off. Story number 2, Hackergate. It's the resurgence of a six-year-old scandal where media owned by media mogul Rupert Murdoch got caught in voicemail espionage. In past years, that espionage was directed in Britain, at least at celebrities. But the story broke on July 3rd by the not-for-profit Guardian newspaper in Britain that the Murdoch-owned News of the World tabloid hacked into and deleted voicemails of Millie Dowler, a 13-year-old girl who was murdered in 2002. The scandal and subsequent revelations shook the British establishment with whiplash speed. The News of the World was shut down 2 weeks after the revelations were made public. At least 13 officials connected with the scandal were arrested. And a proposed Murdoch buyout of Britain's largest pay TV provider, BSkyB, was called off. Stateside, at least three official investigations in the United States of Murdoch properties are now underway, and with at least one whistleblower coming forward to allege that voicemail and other espionage is also occurring at everyone's favorite network, Fox News. Coverage of the scandal in the U.S. corporate media, while present, has arguably been muted, perhaps since those similar shenanigans under Murdoch could also be occurring under other corporate media giants. And with talk that the broadcast licenses of Murdoch-owned TV stations could be at some risk, this is one story that the corporate media are loath to mention. We should do what we can to keep the story alive. Story number three, AT&T's proposed buyout of T-Mobile and the Department of Justice lawsuit to block the merger. When AT&T announced the proposed buyout back in March, which would merge the second and the fourth largest cell phone companies in the United States, and it's a media story because more and more of our media are becoming digital, and the internet, and by extension, cell phone providers are going to be a big player as a result. Many thought the fix looked to be in when that merger was announced, but AT&T made a number of missteps, including getting caught in effectively buying the support of a number of prominent national nonprofit groups, and the result of a key leak of AT&T internal correspondence in which AT&T basically showed their hand. The usually pliant Department of Justice actually filed suit in August to block the merger, which many analysts think that just that filing alone has all but scuttled the merger, even in the unlikely event that the Department of Justice loses that suit. Story number four, the Comcast buyout of NBC Universal and what I call the Baker controversy. In January, after a 13-month review, Comcast was able to win its controversial buyout of NBC Universal. But the glamour behind that merger began to fade almost right away. In May, when one of the approving FCC commissioners, Meredith Atwell Baker, resigned from the FCC to take a new job as the head lobbyist of Comcast. As blatant as this seems, it is actually unfortunately par for the course. FCC commissioners almost always leave the commission to take high-powered jobs in the corporate media apparatus. In April, for another example, former FCC Chair Michael Powell, son of former Secretary of State Colin Powell, became president of the NCTA, National Cable Telecommunications Association, the main commercial cable TV lobby. Comcast and the cable industry has seen the number of cable TV subscriptions shrink in the past year or so. That and the lackluster ratings of NBC has invoked the old saying, be careful what you wish for, you just might get it. Story number five, the formal end of the fairness doctrine. In 1987, the FCC announced it would no longer enforce the policy requiring broadcasters to break the tedium of views on broadcast radio and TV, a policy known as the fairness doctrine. But the law remained on the books, even though it was never really enforced. That is until August of this year, when the FCC, as part of a formal purging of a number of obsolete rules, formally removed the fairness doctrine from the FCC books. While the fairness doctrine has been controversial and may not have done its job as well as was intended, the emergence and growth of the right-wing talk radio establishment was possible once the fairness doctrine was out of the way. And efforts to restore its enforcement was at the very least discussed in Congress in recent years. A restoration of the doctrine or something like it is unfortunately unlikely to undo the damage that has been done. But its dissolution highlights the corporate hammerlock on FCC policy in this country, and the fight for public views is one worth pursuing. Story number six, the net neutrality roller coaster ride. The FCC in December finally passed a net neutrality bill, the policy regarding non-discrimination of content on the internet. But that bill, which the FCC approved, has been criticized as brittle and full of loopholes. and does not extend net neutrality to the wireless realm. Big internet service providers promised and delivered a lawsuit to challenge the FCC authority in granting that law. Media reform groups like Free Press and the Media Access Project also sued the FCC, claiming that the FCC did not go far enough in its legal declaration. And in the worst of all possible worlds, all of the net neutrality lawsuits, six of them, both for and against net neutrality, were consolidated into a single lawsuit. And a lottery was set up to assign which circuit court of appeals that those combined challenges would be heard. The winning circuit, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., is a very pro-corporate court that I think is full of pro-corporate hacks cleverly disguised as judges. As soon as next week, in fact, Congress may take up the question of a resolution of disapproval against net neutrality in a vote that many analysts expect to be very close. We'll continue struggling on this front, but hopes for the short term on this, unfortunately, don't look very good. Story number seven, the Local Community Radio Act. At Media Democracy Day 2010, Sean Campbell of the Chicago Independent Radio Project referred to that act and said there was a chance it might pass. I'm happy to report it did pass. And the story of its passage is inspiring. It showed that a grassroots lobbying effort can defeat even a well-connected, well-funded pro-corporate lobby. Radio Summer launched this past year an effort to encourage local groups nationwide to start their applications for LPFM radio stations to be ready when that FCC filing window for new stations opens, probably sometime next year. That's not to say that it's all smooth sailing ahead, but some very big obstacles have been overcome, and not a moment too soon. Just 2 weeks ago, Clear Channel Communications announced that they are going to lay off perhaps a fifth of their remaining staff and consolidate their resources even further. In some cities, there soon probably won't be any staff running Clear Channel radio stations. Story number eight, advances in supporting public access television. A study released this past summer found that more than 100 public access cable television centers across the United States have closed down entirely due to state cable franchising laws that have been passed going back to 2005. Efforts are underway at the federal level to overturn those laws. American Community Television, abbreviated ACT, is a new lobby on behalf of public access centers and has set up a single goal for itself, to pass legislation to overturn all those state franchising laws and restore local control and local funding to public access television. ACT earned a big win back in May. Model legislation, the Community Access Prevention Act, or the CAP Act for short, has now been formally introduced. We should do what we can to help to make this law, and quickly. On the local front, CAN-TV, Chicago's main public access television provider, is in the middle of once-a-decade contract negotiations with Chicago's servicing cable companies, and is currently at an impasse with RCN. That's one of the main cable companies that provides cable to Chicago. RCN is in negotiations, and they're budging on the issue of funding. So I encourage you to contact RCN and demand that they support CAN-TV. And finally, story number nine, a big win in the media ownership wars. In 2007, then FCC Chair Kevin Martin overturned a number of media ownership rules, and that overturning was sued in court. There was hope for a win at that front. And just in 2003, then FCC Chair Michael Powell engendered a firestorm of protest with a much more dramatic undoing of media ownership rules, and was wound up actually being rebuffed in courts. In 2011, in July of this past year, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia rendered its verdict on the 2007 rewrite. Corporate media attorneys outnumbered the attorneys for media reform activists by a ratio of 10 to 1, but they wound up losing again. The 2000 attempt by the FCC to water down was to water those rules further was struck down. As encouraging as a sign that is, unfortunately, I hate to say it, but we may be too late. We're now seeing the effects across media outlets of what some have called covert consolidation, where TV stations and other media are outright sharing content, sometimes whole reports, and laying off staff as a result. In September, I took part in a conference call involving folks in both Peoria, Illinois, and Rochester, New York, whose two main local TV providers were sharing content in TV stations in both cities and laying off workers in both cities. In one case, one employee in Rochester who had been working since 1975 at a station was recently laid off, and as a result of this wave of covert consolidation. This, I think, will be the next terrain of struggle. to prevent these corporations from wriggling off the hook that we've worked so hard to put them on. In sum, it's been a big year, with more advances, I think, than setback for the first time in a long time, and a bit of hope for a better future. I encourage you to stay involved and stay informed, and I hope you find this presentation informative and useful. If there's anything more I can do to help, let me know. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I am one of the people that are going to sit here and talk to you about not only what we're doing with Chicago Media Action, but what we're doing in the big picture in terms of what is going on with media from the point of view of as Steve said, some of the historical things. As we are going down the pike here, we're very interested in having you know and understand some of the positive programs that are going down, though. Some of the things that we think can fight back as we are hearing some of the dire things. As a matter of fact, I don't know how many of you felt when you were looking at what Steve's piece was, that you were looking not at something that was going on in 1900, yeah. But some things that were very much about what's going on right now. The idea being that we are in a very, very serious place now where there is tremendous consolidation, where there are tremendous interests that are being waged against our interests. But I'm going to talk to you right now about a positive move, or something that I think that we need to know about, that we need to put our energies behind, and that is a countervailing force in a very pragmatic way. And that is the work of Community Media Workshop. Community Media Workshop. I started to say Community Media Action. Community Media Workshop is an organization that's at least 25 years old. It's been in Chicago for many, many years. And it has been about the business of training organizations to do media work in order to get your messages out, if you want to know how to sharpen your messages, if you want to know how to make your voices more effective as nonprofits, because you are packaging yourself properly so that you can fight the power. If you want to understand how to transition, for example, into using social media, which many of our nonprofits are having a rough time doing, there are many, many, many uses that over the years, Tom Clark, who was the originator, who was the founder of that wonderful organization, and you can go to the web and see more about it. The thing that that I have been working with Community Media Action has been something that has to do with a project that Steve Franklin has originated, and it is a project that is designed to raise the awareness, raise the voices of Chicago's ethnic media. That is one of the things that as you took away from what both Mitchell had to say and Steve, is that one of the huge dangers that has happened in the last several years has been that the consolidation of media has meant that the big voices of big corporate voices, conservative voices, have dominated, have 90%, I think you said, Steve? 92%
of
the
market.
That was in 71.
That's
right.
And so now we are being squeezed to pieces. And much of the alternative media that we fought so hard for, as Mitchell was saying in that last piece, such as CAN TV, which is one of the very major alternative medias that we fought very hard to get, is really on the brink because of a lot of
of issues that are kind of technical, but really it's not looking good. The ethnic media, the press, because of some of the same things that must have happened, Steve, during the turn of the century, when they went from 300, right, 38 to 4,
yeah.
Some of those things are happening to our ethnic media, such as the Defender newspaper, which was a great flagship paper for the African American community that we depended on. Ebony magazine, Jet magazine, that really, frankly, spawned the precursor of the civil rights movement. Because if we did not have in the black community the information that was provided by these publications, we would never have known what was going on. We would have never been able to organize. We wouldn't have known what Stokely was saying. So we know that the media was the thing that fired it up. I know that Karen can probably acknowledge that Jet magazine, if you remember, they had a picture of Emmett Till in the casket where he had been killed in Mississippi by the lynch mob. And everybody in the country, all the black people saw it, and they said, oh no, no more. And that was, to me, the beginning of the civil rights movement. So media and the access to information is absolutely critical. And one more story about that is that in the time of Stokely Carmichael, when he was indeed speaking out about some of the atrocities that people simply didn't know about, he was organizing, and he was not only getting college students and young people to become knowledgeable and to tell them, as he here now with the Chicago movement or the Wall Street movement, where are we going to meet? What time should we? When should we gather? That was the kind of thing that when Stokely and people of that ilk were talking about it, J. Edgar Hoover met with all of the editors of the papers and the magazines and the television editors and told them, cut the mic off. Just simply stop reporting what is going on in the black community. Stop reporting the movement, and the movement will die. Well, it didn't, because there were alternative papers and means that could take it up. We didn't have cell phones, but we still had other things that began to be developed. As the thing that I'm saying now is that those alternatives that have been developed are now under attack, but we have some very important things taking their place. Chicago and Chicago Media Workshop has a program that I joined because of its importance. That program was called We Are Not Alone. And the purpose of that program was to unite the voices of the community in being able to describe what was going on in the African-American community and in the Hispanic community. Those two communities that, if combined, would make up almost 70% of this city. We wanted to get those two communities to get to know how very alike they were, how many things that were going on in the communities that were very similar, how many things historically, how culturally similar we are. But secondly, the purpose of the project was to get the business of telling the good news stories. Because if you all are aware, even in our in most of our daily papers and in certainly in most of the news projects, what is the first thing you see on local TV?
Crime.
That's right. If it bleeds, it leads. Isn't that right?
That's right.
And so your picture then of who the young Hispanic or the young African American is, what? Gang leader or gang person, drug addict, a person who is willfully unemployed, and a person who is not a good family person who beats his woman. All of that's totally not true. And all of that means that we needed to be able to tell our own stories to each other.
and tell the good things that are going on in our community, the many, many men who, as stories are now coming out, are caring tenderly for their children, who are well married and are very interesting and wonderful husbands, and who are giving service to the communities. But you need to also know that 7.5 million African-American and Hispanic men and women are in prison or have felony records, something you don't see in the mainstream media. So the purpose of this project, We Are Not Alone, was to not only get the good news stories told and to be able to make a vehicle for cross-cultural awarenesses and cross-cultural discussions, but of course to be able to thirdly be that beginning of the new media, because as things are shut down in terms of our technology, because we're working toward a media that is gonna possibly try to shut down the internet, try to, you know, go to pay only TV, no free TV anymore at all. Radio is also, you know, has been bought up and has been just the voice of conservatives. So what do you go to in times like that? You go to people-to-people communication. You go to voice-to-voice communication. You go to people reaching across age lines and across ethnic lines to talk to each other, to say, here is our commonality. Here's the story I want you to tell. Spread the story among your constituency, and I'll spread your story among mine. Come to the theater, come to ETA, and look at how the things are going on in ETA that tell a story about the desperate things that are going on in the communities in terms of mental health. There's a play there, the theater. You'll hear that exchange made. You'll hear about the films that are being not only shown throughout the community, but the great crowds that are gathering to discuss those films. Films such as Waiting for Superman. How many of you all saw Waiting for Superman? It was a marvelous film that if you got a chance to not only see it, but sit and talk about it with one another, share your thoughts about it, and be able to discuss the fundamental issues, which had to do with charter schools and so forth, you would see what I mean. So this media, this We Are Not Alone project, has really served and is still serving a tremendous benefit to the community. The element of it that I really want to bring to your attention, and that I hope that will really be raised up even further, is that beyond just the cross cross ethnic elements, the cross generational elements are dear to me. As you can see, I'm an elder. You know, my gray hair shows. I proudly wear that concept. And so I am a person that has a viewpoint that may be quite different from some of my 20-year-old friends and relatives and neighbors. I need to learn from them, and they from me. We need to be able, as this project allows us to do, use our whole media system, which means that if there is a good news story that the young people then bring to us, then what we do with it was not only put it on the internet, on Community Media Workshops internet, but then we also see that it is spread to the community newspapers. You're gonna see a collaboration between all of the ethnic media. That's the fourth and probably most powerful part of this, the potential for collaboration. I think that's what Beverly, as she opened this program, talked about how powerful collaboration between media entities could be. And so what's happening here is that a story that is brought to this then goes into the print media of both the Hispanic and the black press. It goes to Telemundo as well as to WYCC or to or to public access, because this really also is about the progressive media also picking it up. It goes into the Facebooks, it goes into the internet and the social media, as well as the traditional media. We have had people come to stories like that, and on WVON, which is a black major radio station that's dominantly about African American issues. We have had the issues that have been brought cross over into being radio stories for days on end, so that it is something that can be absorbed, understood, and a collaboration that has begun to raise all boats. It's a very, very wonderful and very hopeful program. Finally, the thing that I want you to know about this program is that it is morphing into something that is, of course, crossing over beyond just African American, Hispanic. That's just the starting point. It is crossing over into all of the ethnic media, and that's why it was so fascinating to be full circle here from what you started with the 338 ethnic, because at the end of the day, if we what we're seeing, people interested in this whole media democracy day, if what we're seeing is the issue of the war between the 1% that is controlling everything and the 99% of us who may be different ethnic base or complexions or have different points of view in terms of where our origin is, but we are the majority. And so how do we collaborate, get our voices heard, put our hands in each other's hands? And it is by learning through those vehicles that are allowing us to do it on every media level, using the social media, but also using the ethnic media, so that my story is also in Telemundo now. My story is also in La Raza, and my story and their stories in ours. That's the power that Community Media Workshop is spreading. And the last and final thing I'll say that I want you to know, because all of you all probably are connected to organizations. And one of the things across the board that I know and we found out about our organizations in terms of their readiness to participate in this kind of thing that Community Media Workshop is doing, and you do participate in it because this is something you spread too, if you have the skills to do it. But what we're finding across the board is that many of our, particularly our nonprofits, are not prepared to actually do the kinds of really effective media that they could do. So one of the fifth issue that this organization has for all of us is to learn to be that teaching element that teaches us how to effectively tell our stories. It's not enough to have a good story. If you go on and on and on and on, like we elders tend to want to do, we got to learn how to do it in a soundbite. We got to learn how to do it with a little sexy message. We've got to learn how to do it in a way that it can be heard by the popular ear, by the everyday people, not just by the people in our group, but by everyone. So they actually have affordable, accessible training programs to train us in our organizations about how to go about doing that, how to go about getting into the social media, how to go about connecting, therefore, with the young people from different ethnic groups that can come into the organization and translate what you're saying, that can indeed translate it on the internet, or for that matter, put it on the radio, put it in the newspaper in an effective way. So I urge you to see this entity not just for the for this particular project, but to see it as a very important piece that fits very much into something that needs to be seen and understood in order for the 99% of us to prevail and not get crushed and run over by the 1% that has the megaphone right now. Thank you very much.
Gone over a little bit, as you've noticed, I'm sure. I hope you all are willing to stay late, because I know we've got a lot of people here who have a lot to contribute. And so if it's okay, what we'll do now is go right into the symposium. And I'm wondering how you feel. Should we rearrange the chairs, or can we just, would that work if we arrange the chairs, or can we do a symposium the way we're just... Can we rearrange? Okay. So let's kind of rearrange the chairs. So try to make a circle.